This is the first in a series of interviews between Dan Tyler and the daughters of Tom Allen, stockman on the Navajo Indian Reservation from 1929 to 1950, approximately. This particular interview is the first of a number with Mrs. Horace Biggs, who lived on the Navajo Indian Reservation in the area of Fort Defiance and Crown Point and several other places before she left the reservation in 1953. The discussion in this tape deals particularly with Mrs. Biggs' understanding of the chronological events of her father's life. It also deals somewhat with her own experiences, but this is saved for the later tapes. ...of activities which the entire family was involved in. And Mrs. Biggs commented on several aspects of Navajo life, which will be continued in succeeding tapes. This particular tape includes Mrs. Biggs' comments on her father's move from Oklahoma to southern New Mexico, and from there to Albuquerque, and from Albuquerque to Magdalena Country, and eventually to the Navajo Reservation. It is a good chronological survey of her father's activities before being employed by the federal government. The tape does not include what is perhaps Mrs. Biggs' most vivid experience on the reservation, her work as the wife of a trader, and this will be covered in the next tape. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Testing, testing, testing. We don't have to be too formal about the subjects we cover. And any time, incidentally, you feel that there's something that you want to point out, or you're the one who really contributes, not me. I'm just to jog your memory once in a while. So first of all, maybe if you can just summarize in a very rough form your own life from the beginning. You were born on the reservation, right?
No.
No. Okay. Well, let's start from that. Start from where you were born, and perhaps your schooling, where you moved to, what homes you had.
As many
specific dates as possible.
Okay. I was born in October 3rd, 1928 in Chicago, Illinois. Daddy had been sick to Chicago by the Bureau of,
He was doing some work with meat inspection.
Yes, civil service appointment to Chicago to the federal meat, as a federal meat packing inspector. And we evidently, now I haven't gotten this quite straight, but we were only in Chicago about 4 months when I think I arrived early. So I was the only city girl out of the whole bunch of the whole family. And we moved to Fort Defiance when I was 6 months old. So my entire childhood, up to the time I graduated from college, was spent at Fort Defiance.
Which, you, about, what year did you graduate?
I graduated in 1949. So from 1929 to 1949, I lived at Fort Defiance.
Okay. Now, did you live in the same place at Fort Defiance all the time?
We lived in two different houses. The first house we lived in was next door to the other house we later moved into. And the second house we moved in, we must have moved in when I was probably, I would think probably about 5 years old. And this was rather a status house. This was where the superintendent had lived. And it was a beautiful house. It was a big rock home. And it had three very large bedrooms upstairs and a bath and a big playroom, and it had two bedrooms downstairs, and the bathrooms were so elegant for that day and time. It had been built for the superintendent of the Navajo Reservation.
You don't know how old the house was, do you?
Gee, I don't know. It must have been, I would guess maybe it was 10 or 12 years old when we moved in it. But,
Was it built by the Indians themselves?
This I don't know either. At that time, you know, all the government houses were furnished by the government service. And we had, it was very well done. It was very well furnished, and the house itself was really quite lovely.
Okay, so from the standpoint of what we're trying to get at here, your perspective on the Navajo was essentially from the Fort Defiance area.
Right.
I mean, you obviously left that area, but your home was in Fort Defiance for this 20-year period.
Anytime I have a dream, even today, it's always in that house. I mean, that's how deep I think my roots went there.
Okay, that's good to know that.
Uh-huh.
Fine. Now, you graduated from college in 1949, but you didn't leave the reservation then, did you?
No.
So what happened?
I graduated from college in 48. I was married in 49. I went to Crown Point to teach in 48 and 49. And that's when Daddy had been sent to Crown Point on the assignment that he was sent to Crown Point. Mother moved to Albuquerque that year. And I taught school at Fort Defiance, at Crown Point that year, and kept house for Dad.
And lived where in Crown Point?
Well, there again is kind of a funny little story. When Daddy was sent to Crown Point, he was sent as the superintendent. And the superintendent's house at that time, you know, the government service was very, very snooty. They were very persnickety where you lived, you know, status symbols, which Daddy always kind of thumbed his nose at. He took the big house at, we always called it the big house, at Fort Defiance because we had a large family and he needed it.
What was the, to digress here for a minute, what was the social echelon? You mentioned the status symbol.
Mm-hmm.
This is extremely important, I think, to what we're trying to get at.
Yeah, because I think this bugged Daddy more than anything going.
Okay, now what was the top echelon from the government's point of view, and what was the bottom?
The superintendent, I suppose, was
the
top. I don't know whether that's still true today or not, whether Nakai lives in the house at Window Rock that they built for the superintendent. I think he probably does. You were graded by the quality of house that you lived in. And the house that we lived in Fort Defiance for many years was the superintendent's house. And there were many people, and I can remember this because we must have lived in that house 5 or 6 years. And I know that there were many people who didn't like Daddy in the government service people, the people in the community of Fort Defiance. They just plain didn't like him. And as we go into this, you'll begin to see more. And I think they resented us living in this superintendent's house. So when Ruth and Ruby and Buford were no longer at home, Daddy said, well, he would be happy to move back into the other house if they fixed it up the way he wanted it. So at that time, Dad proceeded to remodel the house that we had lived in before. And he really made it quite lovely. He just, you know what a scrounger Daddy always was, and he ordered this and that and the other thing and remodeled a complete house, whereby it was actually, when he finished it, a nicer home than the Big Rock House was. And the way they got him out of the Big Rock House was on the pretense of transferring him to Window Rock when they built Window Rock. And he said he wouldn't go to Window Rock. This was another thing that kind of bothered the people in the community. Nobody else told anybody what they would do or wouldn't do, and Daddy just did. He said he wasn't going to move to Window Rock, and he didn't. But and I don't know how he managed all these things, but he did. So they built, remodeled the smaller house, which was right next door to the Rock House for us. And we moved back in to the other house where we lived the rest of the time that we were at Fort Defiance.
Yeah, okay, now your father was officially a Stockman at this time?
Well, I'm not sure. He was... I don't think... they had what they called range riders.
Okay, this is
And
important.
I think they were the stockmen.
No, I think if I can maybe approach it from the point of view of the records,
mm-hmm.
it looks to me like there is a range rider on the bottom. That's what we're talking about here in the social ladder, I think.
Uh-huh.
He was the man who was in really direct contact with the individual clans and hogans that mm-hmm. existed in his district. Then
well,
above
Daddy
him
had
was a stockman. I think he got promoted from range rider to stockman.
Yeah.
And then I wonder what was between stockman and superintendent, or did he report directly to the superintendent?
Well, Mr. Hunter was the superintendent when Daddy went to Fort Defiance. And Mr. Hunter was really the last, they used to have a superintendent in each agency. Fort Defiance was an agency, Shiprock was an agency, Tuba City was an agency, so on. And there was a superintendent at each agency. Then when they built Wind Rock, they made one superintendent. And my earliest recollection of who the superintendent was Trotter. Daddy can tell you more about that.
No, I don't know too much about it.
Then supposedly, theoretically, then all the heads of the department were to move to Wind Rock. And at this point, Daddy said he wouldn't go to Wind Rock.
Well, do you have recollections of visiting with these people, with the superintendent and his wife? Was there a social chasm between the two of you?
No.
Or were you...
When John Hunter was at Fort Defiance, actually, I think Daddy did John Hunter's job. I think, and we shouldn't quote names here. we should strike out that John Hunter.
This business about the, not right now, but this business of the government really is going to end up being one of our focal points. So
good.
I think that your impressions of associations with government men from a social standpoint, and then your father's impressions of his work with them from a business standpoint, will come together quite nicely and give us a better idea of what was really going on, because nobody knows exactly how the government policies were received and what difficulties people like your dad had when they were supposed to put them into operation. We do know that a lot of the Washington language was very difficult to translate into Navajo, either in words or in ideas.
Uh-huh.
You know, but we don't really know, because we don't have enough people like your father and yourself to tell us exactly why Washington continued to fail to understand that they couldn't make up beautiful orders with long polysyllabic words, and then have these translated into operation on the reservation. In short, the government doesn't know why it failed.
Really? They don't know why they failed?
Really. Because the whole business of government, of Indian policy, is still a very confusing area. And nobody really knows yet what the best Indian policy should be today or should have been then.
Well, I suppose that's true. It looks so simple to me, I can't see how it can be.
Well, I think essentially that's why we're talking, you see, from the standpoint of the Indian research program. From the standpoint of your family's interest, of course, you're trying to get your father's recollections down. But,
right.
But I think from the standpoint of what hopefully will become useful material, your impressions will help point out to the government perhaps where it erred and where it might improve upon its present program.
Well, of course, that will be from a personal viewpoint, but I think that we would be able to give a pretty, well, of course, it would be biased opinion, but I was born and raised in it. I mean, it was just as natural as breathing to me.
Well, were you very conscious of the heavy-handedness of the government officials? Did you have a feeling, can you remember a feeling of being... very Navajo and anti-government?
Yes. In the first place, we'll go back to where I was going to tell you about Mr. Hunter, John Hunter, who was the superintendent at that time. I think Dad did a lot of Mr. Hunter's job for him because he drank a lot, Mr. Hunter did. And Daddy and Mr. Hunter were very good friends.